Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the HITACH Annual Report Workgroup. I'm pleased to welcome our co-chairs, Nadel Briggs-Melanson and Aaron Meary, along with our workgroup members, Hannah Galvin, Anna McAllister, and Eliel Lavera, who are all today. Hans Wildendijk and Georges are not able to join us. Public comments are welcomed, which can be typed in the Zoom chat or can be made verbally during the public comment period that will be held later in our meeting. And now I'd like to turn it over to Nadel and Aaron to get us started today.
Sure. Nadel, you want to start?
All right. So good afternoon, everyone. It's so great to see you all here for our annual work group meeting. This is another exciting meeting. We're going to be able to get through so many of the different items and topics and prioritization today. So I'm really happy to see you all. And I'll turn on over to Aaron so we can jump right on in.
Absolutely. Look forward to today's discussion. And of course, as a preview again, we have our HITACH this Thursday, so don't be there or be square. We got to make sure we're ready for that, and this will help inform that conversation as well. So look forward to today's talk. Let's get to it. So the agenda for today, obviously, we're going through our meeting schedules and next steps. We'll do a discussion on draft crosswalks today. We're looking at for the topics in the green. We're also talking about discussion of illustrative story ideas for the HITACH annual report in FY23. As a reminder, the stories are something we started about two or three cycles ago. And it's meant to put into plain, understandable English, kind of like talk to me like I'm 8 years old, explain to me why this, what the patient experience or what the clinical experience would be like if we were to get interoperability properly done, or what would it help from a cybersecurity perspective, or what could we prevent occurring, right? In very plain English, these stories anchor each of the sections that we're going through here, interoperability, cybersecurity, public health, et cetera, and just explain to the general reader in plain English what that means. So we'll start talking about those today. It's a fun process, and usually we brainstorm up some really good ones for those of you who are brand new in the committee, and it really comes together very strongly at the end. Go to public comment, and the next steps and adjourn. Next slide. All right, next slide. So we are here at the 16th of October, which is amazing how fast time is flying by. Next meeting will be the 30th of November, right after Thanksgiving. And of course, December, going to the draft for HITACH review and approval sometime January, February timeframe for transmittal then thereafter. Next slide. Like I said, HITACH this Thursday, 10 o'clock in the morning Eastern time. We will update and discuss the crosswalk. This is about the point in the HITACH sessions that we start getting some really good feedback. But I will ask all of you as work group members to help pull out comments from your fellow HITACH colleagues that you know folks have on the top of their mind. Maybe you're just hesitating to say something. We really want to collect all feedback. It's important. This is a collective work effort and any feedback therein. And of course, then on the 9th, we'll do another status update, and then the 18th with a final approval on the 8th of February. Next slide. Okay, let's go into the draft crosswalk. And then, of course, we'll be presenting this, pieces of it at least, at the main HITACH this Thursday. Then I think, Michelle, from here, we go right into the work, the crosswalk, correct? Our Excel team?
Yes, you can do that.
Okay, perfect. All right, crosswalk time. All righty.
Great. Aaron, you want me to go ahead and kick off for the crosswalk? So we're just going to focus on some of the green topics that we had before. And then we want to, as Aaron mentioned, go back and start to prioritize where we want to really list all of these topics. So we left off last time here on artificial intelligence. And just to take another step back, these were some of the additional items at the very end of the crosswalk and of our meeting last time that we met that we really wanted to just kind of synthesize together a bit more and make sure that this is where we want it to land in terms of proposal for the annual report. So first starting off with artificial intelligence, in which we then decided to try to combine the algorithmic bias and transparency. And so just to orient everyone to all of the various different colors, the teal text, of course, came from 925. The red additional text is from all of the homework that we did have. So thank you everyone for doing your homework and providing all of those comments back to the team. And then the green text will then be that from today's work group. So you have all of the various different texts from our last meeting that we had on 9/25. And then the red is some of the additions that we want to go over. And thank you, Hannah, for making sure to add some of those pieces in. And you'll see at least some of the various different suggestions that are there. And so there was one question that came up from Hannah. And so maybe we can display that comment or question for us to discuss. And so, Hannah, did you want to just give us this additional context to your question?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I'm actually trying to pull up the full document myself because I can't see my comment in
We're displaying it right here.
Okay, perfect. Yep, that view that I have. Yeah. So, right. So I think that my comment here sort of focuses on the fact that even though we talk about that patients and caregivers can be involved in determining what may constitute FAVES, providers and developers and healthcare organizations need some additional guidance about how to evaluate AI modules for those FAVES and to understand any potential implications around implementation for any specific patient population. Even when there's some transparency around how an algorithm works, right? And so there is some guidance out there from professional societies. There is some guidance out there from other federal agencies. But I think that could be part of all of this as well, helping to align and coordinate that guidance about how best to evaluate and implement decision support interventions. And having the transparency is part of that, defining the FAVES is part of that, but also giving that education around what do I do with that transparency? What do I do with that FAVES information and coordinating some of those recommendations could be part of that as well.
Absolutely. And I love those different ideas and comments as well, Hannah. And I think that that's some of the things that we had discussed even last time about one, the importance of us at least trying to hold some type of listening session where we're bringing all the entities together to understand how do we actually apply this, just as you mentioned, or understanding how that is in terms of transparency and getting a clear kind of unified understanding of this approach. But then also, most importantly, how physicians and other clinicians and patients should actually use this information as well. So all really great points there.
And I like your comment there, Madel, because I had a meeting with ARC last week and they're looking forward to this coming out, right? Because there's a lot of research work on quality perspective they're waiting for HTI-1 to come out with. So to your point, how it also informs the other agencies as well. So there's a uniform approach. So I think it's spot on, accurate, and everybody's excited about this being finalized. Anna, I see your hand raised.
Yes. And my apologies for not being able to make the meeting on 9/25. I had a episode of acute neuropathy in both of my feet and was a little out of it. So forgive me for just getting up to speed. I guess my question about this, and to call it a concern is very much an overstatement. But I'm a little hesitant to group this under technologies that advance health equity, just because I think health equity is a significant and very important concern as it relates to AI. I completely understand that. And, health equity, whether it's based off of, ethnic issues or geographic locations or whatever, really needs to be thought through greatly within the context of this. But I think my concern is, a patient advocate who's been very focused on quality measures and outcomes measures over the years, is that some of the stuff that isn't working all that well in our current analog system for developing outcomes measures is going to get transported into AI tools, and what is determined, what the algorithm is maximizing for as the be-all, end-all of outcomes or quality may not actually match with what is relevant to patients, or not just from like a PRO perspective, but from a, what are the outcomes that are actually a far more accurate assessment of whether or not somebody is healthy or not, or ill or not. So, I mean, I don't know how that necessarily impacts it, but I think it's something that is inclusive of health equity, but also encompasses other areas of concern that I and others have as it relates to the incorporation of AI into EHR technology and, you know, certified health technology.
Great. And so, Anna, just to make sure that we understand, so what you're saying is that, I mean, yes, you're saying that AI in general is very broad, and I think there's some other aspects of AI that absolutely need to be addressed. But are you saying that not to have it in the health equity section, but have it underneath a different section? And what are some of those other sections that you're recommending?
I don't know that I've thought it through that far, to be completely honest. So my apologies for that. I mean, I definitely think it's absolutely relevant to health equity. And we're all familiar with how things can go badly awry in that situation. Just looking through some of the other categories. Mm-hmm. Forgive me.
So one thing I may say, Anna, and this is something that I always love for people to also fully know. For instance, the definition of high quality care defined by the Institute of Medicine is based off of 6 primary principles that care has to be patient-centered, timely, effective, efficient, safe, and equitable. So you cannot have high quality outcomes if it's not equitable by its nature, because equity is part of high quality care. And so just wanted to sort of put that out there, because you were bringing up the importance of quality outcomes, which I 100% agree with you, because that's part of my profession is really driving high quality outcomes, safe outcomes, but equity is fully integrated into that, because they can't be equitable. You can't be high quality if it doesn't have that important 6th tenet of equity. And so that's what is that kind of part of what you're saying? Like it goes across so many of the different domains that we think about in terms of equity. So not just to center it here, or just trying to make sure that, you know, just full clarification there.
So, I mean, I'll give you some concrete examples just from my personal health care issues and frustrations with what the healthcare system is designed to maximize for, or at least use as a determinant of whether or not I'm healthy or appropriately treated. Hemoglobin A1C, I like to say it's like using the farmer's almanac to plan your afternoon. If you're maximizing for hemoglobin A1C, there are a lot of things you're missing that could be better captured and more relevantly used as guidance for treatment, such as continuous glucose monitoring. So if the inputs if everything is being maximized in an algorithm related to diabetes, again, just to use a very crude example, something that we all understand is A1C, that's not going to get you, I mean, that is not going to get you the best outcomes for especially people with type 1 diabetes or people who are on insulin. Another example is hemoglobin levels for anemia. I mean, that is the bane of my existence, because we use that as a way of assessing whether or not people can get access to certain medications. And it's like we're maximizing towards specific hemoglobin levels, and that's all incorporated into sort of a black box algorithm or some sort of an AI system. The way that it, like the outputs that it will spit out may not actually be appropriate for a patient. So I, as a patient, would want to know what exactly are these algorithms maximizing for, which is a little different than all of the various and complicated aspects related to health equity and sort of baked in social discrimination or discriminatory patterns. So I see them as kind of qualitatively different, if that makes sense.
Got it. So very clear, Anna. Thank you so much for describing that. And I will tell you a couple of different things. One, we do have AI in many of the other sections, but true equity is not just rooted on, for instance, ethno-racial categories or gender identities or sexual orientation or faith. Is actually also related for people uniquely on who they are with their various different disease states or physiologic conditions. That is what true equity is, and it encompasses it all. And so your points are well taken. And so maybe as we proceed on, we put that pin exactly as you said to see if there's any other sections that we can really amplify that understanding and that transparency into how these algorithms are working to ensure that there's no unintentional harm for people that have certain medical conditions or certain other types of characteristics. And because we want everyone to be supported and thrive in that. So it makes very clear sense that way.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions about this topic? Are we all good with this here?
We're good.
All right. Well, sounds like we'll keep on moving on. All right. And I think what we're doing is that we're just looking at some of the various different additions for some of these areas. And so once again, there was missing health IT infrastructure for health equity and social drivers of health data. We see some of the various different additions that we discussed last time in terms of the adding of the public health organizations and social service providers. And then some of the proposed activities we have here. Thank you, Excel, for moving over. A little bit more. Is there any other comments there? And then thank you. We have Hannah's prioritizations there too. Any other thoughts about this topic? This, again, we're just going through some of the additions that were there.
I made some comments down to the side as well. Two comments. One is the wording of the public health organizations, which I know we talked about a little bit last time, but in social service providers. Just maybe I need to loop back to sort of what we said last time and how we're defining public health organizations, right? Because there's some different framing around actual departments of public health versus sort of social service providers and CBOs. And so I think I wondered whether or not we wanted to group all of those together. Including sort of, then there are some other sort of like schools could be maybe a public health organization. So whether we were including departments of public health as a public health organization in this grouping, because I think we attend to some of the public health reporting below. And so I think I had a question about that. So that was one question. The other piece that I wanted to attend to in this area was sort of a larger question around, right, we really need to build out the infrastructure around CBOs and social service providers. Some of the data that is relevant to those organizations includes social drivers, but it also includes a lot of other data like USCDI version 1 data, just basic PAMI data, basic demographic data. And I wonder whether or not we are confounding a little bit because we sort of think about social drivers and then we think about, you know, when I get data around a social driver, I refer out to a community-based organization for, say, food insecurity or transportation insecurity. And so therefore, that is the first data that I would share with them. But I would say in reality, in clinical practice, that may not be the first or only data that I would share with them. I would share with them demographic data. And so the focus on just sharing social driver data, as opposed to building out an infrastructure for CBOs and social service providers that shares basic ADT demographic data, you know, starting at the beginning of when we built out certified EHR technology data. I think is sort of some of my question here, and whether or not that whether or not we're sort of confounding the sharing of social driver data with just building out that infrastructure and the sharing of even sort of basic data first and patient matching within that ecosystem in their own. Does that make sense, or am I not making sense to?
No, I think it makes sense. Would love to hear what the group has to say. I have some thoughts, but would love to hear what the work group has to say about Hannah's questions. Any thoughts?
I'll be honest, I could go either way. I mean, just being very candid. I mean, I see your point, but I also see the way we had it written too. I mean, it's I can see it both ways. That's I guess I'm struggling with that, is trying to reconcile one over the other. Because you're right, there is public health data is a little bit different and unique. However, from an interoperability perspective and exchange data, it's still the same types of parameters, right, to make happen. So I guess I'm sort of torn, lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say in terms of the two questions, number one, I think when we said public health organizations, we were really thinking about public health organizations, meaning right. Departments of public health throughout the country, especially coming out of the pandemic. We know the challenges with interoperability that we had on so many levels with just communicating between our provider organizations, our public health organizations, our governmental organizations, et cetera. So Hannah, I think that's what we were thinking of initially when we included public health organizations. It was truly like those that deliver services for the health of the general public. Mm-hmm. But you bring up other important factors like schools and others. And I think that that's an important piece. But that's also another subset of some of, I would say, more of our it's hard to really sort of navigate where it is. And I would caution us from getting too narrow when we're still even trying to do some of the high level work that we know that we need to provide all of the appropriate care to the general public as well. So I think that was one of the initial thoughts, and public health organizations are different from social service organizations or community-based organizations based off of their scope and what their primary missions and objectives are. And in terms of the SDOH data versus, you know, you're right, like everything from just our basic demographic data, I think I just took that implicitly that if we've already developed the infrastructure to exchange social driver data, we can't really exchange social driver data without having the information on who that patient is, that data is linked to, like which patient that is, which would include, of course, all of our various different demographic information and everything that is in USCDI 1. So I think that's where my perception was of that. It was kind of all inclusive because we're taking a step further.
Got it. And that's, I think, why I think I rated, if you scroll down, the gaps in infrastructure as immediate, and this is longer term, because I saw needing to address those gaps first and the gaps in infrastructure first, and then once we sort of put those gaps in place as this follows on that. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we had the same sort of understanding there. If we think that all of that related to social drivers should be incorporated together in this one, including addressing some of the infrastructure gaps, then perhaps we should address it all together here, as opposed to addressing the gaps, the infrastructure gaps separately. So that was my only sort of piece. Down on the next page, the top of the next page, where we talk about gaps in infrastructure, is what I sort of thought of as a prerequisite to being able to really support this, or better support that this one.
Awesome. No, all great observations. And it's kind of like we cannot, if again, I think in pyramids, you cannot get to the top of a pyramid without building the foundation. And so although that may be where your vision is, all of that basic information has to be there first in order for the entire system to work appropriately. So all very good points about whether we make it more explicit what we're referring to when we talk about improving the interoperability in the space. All right, any other thoughts or comments on this? Okay, everyone's a little quiet, pondering today. All right, let's get through these two, and then Aaron, I'm gonna turn it on over to you and we'll kind of go through them because we wanna try and see how much we can get through today since we have to present to all of HITECH on Thursday. Yeah, so reducing the digital divide. This is exactly what we discussed last month. But one of the things that we do have is, of course, looking at the additional data elements about a patient's internet access status, digital literacy status, and health literacy status. So thank you, Hannah, you added in that additional health literacy status.
Yeah, I actually asked a question about the health literacy status. I think Michelle added it in. Okay. And I just added some clarification that it may be, I was back and forth about it because it can just be assessed by different personnel and that we just need to define it a little bit. But I know we talked about it last time about whether to include it or not include it. But right, different people can define health literacy differently. And so I was just sort of thinking that if we include it as we sort of discussed last time, we should sort of further define kind of what we mean by that. I agree that it's incredibly important, but I want to make sure that we have some clear definitions since it's,
Yeah, I mean, would that be, and again, my apologies for missing last time, but would that be just like sort of a gut check sense from, either the medical assistant or nurse or physician, like noted in their record, or is there some sort of standardized assessment of health literacy or like the smiley faces as it relates to health tech? I mean, I don't know. It's like, do you like health tech? Do you hate health tech? Pick the emoji that works best for you. I mean, I don't know how that would be assessed and who would do the assessing.
So health literacy assessments is actually, there's functionality in the vast majority of EHRs in order to document one's health literacy status. This is typically performed in some level of intake, whether it's outpatient or inpatient. Is it universal across all of our systems? I'm not quite sure it is. However, there's a lot of new push in legislation from both our governmental and our accrediting agencies in which you absolutely need to assess for health literacy status. Now, health literacy status is different from digital literacy status, although they are related. So digital literacy status is normally how one's comfort and understanding of using various different forms of technology, whether it's the technology itself or whether navigating within that technology itself. While health literacy, and then we also is really also related to your literacy status, but health literacy is how you process all of that health information that's provided to you and in what types of forms. So there's really kind of general literacy, health literacy, digital literacy. It's almost like I always like to describe it as a Venn diagram, but each one of them focuses on a different area. But oftentimes that core between them tends to be the area that if you do assist somebody in that core, it will also help in some of the other areas, especially when it comes to general literacy and health literacy. Digital literacy is a little different because it still has to deal with the devices and some of the technology itself, but they are kind of related. So the question is, and I see here from the comments from Hannah, you were just mentioning. So Anna, yes, we do assess it. It's not as consistent as what it should be, because even if we assess it, we should be following up on it with additional resources to ensure that patient is receiving all of the information in an appropriate way. But there is a huge push to ensure that this is not only always recorded for every single patient, but also those resources are provided. And then, so I would say, you know, Hannah, to your point, should health literacy actually be included in what we were talking about, the digital divide? It's related, but not 100% the same.
Yeah, and I think it's great to include it. Since, as far as I know, at least there's not a standard out there for assessing it. It would be great to, you know, one of the things is to propose a standard or at least define it, right? At least define and maybe suggest that be a future, you know, in the future, there'd be some type of standard for assessing it. But yeah, that was my only sort of comment on that.
Thank you all for all of those. Any other questions, comments? Okie dokie, let's go on to the last one then. So the last one was, again, going back to reducing the digital divide, but increasing access to and accessibility of telehealth services. We just see some of the changes that were made based off of our last discussion. It looks like the highlighted, and just Excel team, are you able to unclick that? Was that highlighted for a reason?
I think it's because I put a comment there.
Oh, okay. So the comments there were explore the benefits and challenges of encouraging the adoption of security and accessibility standards by telehealth providers. And so Hannah, do you want to go over some of your comments there?
Yeah, I just recall that the previous time we had said something about maybe ONC working in its coordinating capacity with other agencies to ensure that the public payers are at least supporting equity in the payment of telehealth. That was my recollection of something that we talked about. And I think that would be more immediate. But I rated the other pieces as longer term. So that had been my recollection from the previous conversation that I didn't see fully captured there.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and definitely there was that mention of that. I think Michelle kind of hit the nail on the head there, in which since this does fall so much into CMS's domain, likely maybe a few others, when it does come to our recommendations on behalf of HITACH to ONC, just trying to really make sure that we're squarely within ONC's kind of jurisdiction, but of course encouraging if there is any other collaboration or discussions to really reinforce not only the continuation of this type of technology, but making sure that it is equitable in access as well. Any other thoughts here?
I think it's straightforward. Adele, I don't have any comments.
Great. Awesome. So thank you, Hannah, for that. Really good points there. Okay, so we went through these items. And let's go on to the next page.
I think the next green slide or cell is page 6. Is that true, Excel team? All right, so streamlining health information exchange. Hannah, do we want to talk about your comments here? It looks like the only addition is the word "the," but I mean, Hannah, you want to kind of talk about your comments there to the support data linking target area?
Yes. I don't know why I didn't have a proposed here. I'm just looking here. Oh, yes. Oh, it's, I think it was because we had, I'm just looking at Michelle's comments as well. So we have the support data linking target area above, which I thought encapsulated our recommendations. And we focused on TEFCA, over listening sessions with other government agencies. Oh, so I thought maybe we need to reconcile the two priority areas. And Michelle clarified that the goal was to identify future standards priorities for consideration. But yeah, I think I just thought that this was similar to what we had in the was the support data linking topic above. It's under priority target area interoperability. So maybe you guys are able to help me understand this is a recurring topic that we've talked about year after year, as opposed to the topic that we have under priority target area interoperability, which is something that we're proposing de novo this year. Is that correct?
Which, point me to the other one you're looking at. I'm trying to search the document.
It's the bottom of page 3.
Oh, okay, got it. And you're looking at this data linking one?
Yeah, the supporting data linking. And right, we were saying that we need a national standardized method for linking healthcare data is needed. And we said we would explore possibilities for national data linkage, especially across QHINs. We'd hold a listening session. And then this one down here, we talked about streamlining health information exchange, that we have some gaps. We want to explore the development of implementation guidance that enables increased consistency of the data exchange. I'm trying to remember what I was thinking here.
Well, maybe what you're going towards, Hannah, is a potential merging of the two topics, right?
Because that was what I was going for, the two topics need to, right? We need data linking in order to streamline again, this is like, it sort of like, we need sort of, one is sort of a dependency of the other, and do we need to sort of...
It's a fair question. No, it's a very fair question, Hannah. I don't know, what's the group think? I mean, I see that, it makes sense.
Yeah, I just pulled up the entire document. I was just looking at those two items that you were referring to, Hannah. Yeah, and I think, yes, it would make sense for us to combine them and not have redundancy there.
Yeah,
sure.
That's a good call.
Because
you're right, Hannah, one of these has been reoccurring over and over and over again. And so it's been on there, but now we have this other section too. So yeah, it's time to reconcile. It's a good point. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. I think let's go to page 7, SL team. All right. One of my favorite topics here, cybersecurity events across healthcare infrastructure. So it keeps me up at night. Okay. Your comments, Hannah, not sure how effective a listening session will be per se. CISA, best practices against agencies. Okay, so are you proposing that we do more than just a listening session?
Yeah, I would expand it. I got to see, actually, since I made these comments, I listened to, or I watched a listening session that some congressional committee did with University of Vermont and a couple mm-hmm. of organizations that had security events. And I actually found it very helpful in thinking about my own organization's cybersecurity readiness. So I think a listening session actually is helpful after thinking that through. But I also think working across federal agencies to compile best practices, because there's only so many kind of ad hoc sort of examples that you can listen to, and then we need some recommended best practices.
Interesting. Okay. I like that. I love the idea. Mm-hmm. Comments from the group? Feedback? Is that under ONC's jurisdiction, or is that really CISA to provide that? I don't know.
It would feel like a thing that would be done with ONC and CISA. I mean, it is a specific risk to...
Yeah, fair point. Healthcare, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's a good question for even the ONC staff. Like, where does this come from, and how do you coordinate that? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Okay. a great suggestion. Compile information, put it in one place, like a chapel of sorts.
Or maybe, I mean, again, this is just me who I am not an expert in cybersecurity, but, you know, maybe ONC/HHS takes up, works with sites to develop some sort of like a hacker-based defense mechanism, like what DARPA has done previously for DOD and for the broader infrastructure. I mean, I know they've done a ton of work on this and have been doing it for a long time. I don't get the sense that ONC has had that within their jurisdiction or the HHS has. I could be completely wrong about that, but.
Be good to know, be good to find out. You make a great point, Anna. I don't even know.
And Anna, I agree with exactly what you said in terms of what is truly ONC's jurisdiction in this space. Because this has been a trending topic in terms of cybersecurity. And so when it comes to, for instance, even our role or ONC's role in this, really helping to define that a bit more, just because as we're coming up with these recommendations here, we also want to make sure, I mean, there's that the piece for us and for our knowledge so that we can be better, a better group to provide recommendations to ONC. But then we also, I think, truly need to understand what ONC's role is in these cybersecurity events and management so that we can be even more relevant when it comes to our recommendations. So I absolutely agree with really defining or really exploring a bit more about that jurisdiction of ONC in this space.
Yeah, agreed. And of course, and there's a federal rep too, Ram Saram, who could also help coordinate and give us some answers as well. So I think this is a great, great point to double click on and just find out some more. Be great to educate everybody on, be quite honest with you. So that's a good suggestion. Okay. Not that one. Let's go to the next one on. So around patient access information. So limited guidance for safety and security of mobile health applications. And Hannah, your comments here is a way to combine this with AI tools. Okay, you want to kind of walk us through your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just thought that at a very high level, right, at the time that we first started asking around about, saying we need some guidance around mobile health tools, the guidance is what mobile health tools should providers recommend, what mobile health tools should patients feel comfortable using. We fast forward now to 2023. Many, not all, mobile health technologies are, like every technology, are touting some version of AI, but they may or may not. But again, the high level question we're still saying is, how can we be transparent about what data it is being used? What, you know, how you're using my data? What am I going to get out of this application, right? And so I think my thought was that at a high level, isn't the question sort of similar? How can the public or how can implementers who may not be technology experts or have some degree of technology expertise understand the pros and cons of utilizing a specific tool, whether it incorporates specifically AI algorithms or not, more rules-based tools or some other tool, right? And so that's why I was wondering if maybe it might make sense to sort of group that together. But Michelle responded and said that we cannot actually do that because
there's a
CARES Act issue. So that, I think that was sort of my thought there was,
it's a great suggestion, I guess. I mean, yeah. Michelle's the expert though, so we have to default to her.
So why did she say we can't do this?
I think one of them is specified in the Cures Act specifically.
Yeah, I'll clarify a little bit. Cures Act spells what the high tech can deliberate on, and there are like three priority target areas and there are additional target areas. Unfortunately, it was written a few years ago, AI wasn't so prominent, so it doesn't have kind of the more newer topic areas that we might want to cover. You can go to Congress and kind of do a request to say, I want to add a target area, at least temporarily. But our temporary solution So we have to go that far and involve lawyers possibly to make that happen. We don't have really a process in place to do that easily, is to use existing target areas and use the AI as a theme. So where it falls into each target area kind of overlaps. It plays both roles. So if that clarifies enough for us.
Anna, does that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
Anna and Hannah, I guess both.
No, yeah.
I think it makes sense. I mean, I'm trying to get my head around exactly what it is we're trying to do. I mean, we certainly don't want to create barriers to mobile health apps, but I mean, given that, you know, there are basically two places where people download apps. One is, you know, with Apple, the other is with Google. Maybe the recommendation would be for ONC to work with, you know, Apple and Google, you know, the App Store folks and the Google Store folks about creating criteria for, like the standards they establish for what makes it into their marketplaces. That might be a way of doing it that would be sort of low touch regulatory, give these, you know, to like companies the ability to work with government to enforce what does and does not make it into these marketplaces as a way of ensuring, you know, their customers are actually accessing data that's substantial and meaningful. And I mean, they have an interest in incorporating it into their own health kit so that it can be interoperable with other apps on their platforms as well as with EHRs. So I don't know, it's just a thought.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and I about the private public partnership that you're referring to, because that's where a lot of marketplaces are leaning towards. And I had a quick discussion with a group of innovators truly about a week and a half ago about this exact aspect. And they're all in the app space, and they're all in sort of the algorithm space and the some in the device space. And they were saying, you know, where is legislation going to lead for us as, you know, health technology innovators, and especially when we do feel like we have solutions that will greatly help people's outcomes, but we also don't want to be X'd out of the marketplace by having to jump through a lot of bureaucracy or various different criteria. And so one of the things that we're discussing is that we have to, again, make sure that these apps are rooted in integrity and that are truly going to be abiding by what is going to promote greater health. And not causing any unintentional harm. But of course, we also want to make sure to bring more of those innovators into the space to help us transform health and healthcare. So, you know, I don't really know the answer to this at all, but it's something that I think we're going to continue to see growing interest from both sides, because seems like we do need those safeguards, but yet this may be an area that we actually do things a little differently than what we have done before in the past in terms of like quote unquote certification or whatever that may be in order to benefit the overall public. So just great conversation. I just wanted to bring some of those additional real world concerns onto the plate as well.
Other comments in the group? Other thoughts? Okie doke. If not, then I think the next phase of this, Michelle, keep us honest here, is prioritization. Is that correct?
Yes. Just if there's any other questions on any other topics, content before you move on, then yes, you can go to prioritization.
Great. And so maybe, Aaron, as Excel is going up to the top, yep. Hannah, thank you. You've already started prioritization. But for the entire work group, as we mentioned last time, and just to bring everyone up to speed, we always like to go through all of the various different topics and think about if they fall into one of two categories. Is this for immediate action, meaning as we define our report, we say this is an immediate recommendation, which should really hopefully be implemented over the next 12 months? Or is this more of have a long-term recommendation in which it will be executed in greater than 12 months. And I believe we have a legend of near-term or immediate versus long-term, but if not, that's approximately where that lies. And so what we always like to do is to go through all of the topics and make sure that all of us are, we have a consensus on if this is something that we immediately need to address in terms of our recommendations, or it's a long-term action for us.
Yeah. And a legend at the bottom, it says immediate calendar years 24 and 25.
Great.
And longer term is anything beyond 25. Just think of it that way.
Excellent. And I did not even see that legend here on the screen. I knew we had it there somewhere.
Yeah. It's the very, very bottom of page 8, but yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. All right. So let's go through this then.
All right, so we'll jump. Aaron and I are just, we're just going to flow with this today, you all.
Let's roll.
So verse, starting off with our target area for design and use of technologies that advance health equity. So going back to the AI algorithmic bias and transparency, do we think that this is an immediate, meaning something that we need to provide a recommendation for within 24, 25, or could this be longer term?
I don't think it's not immediate. Sorry, go ahead.
I would think it's immediate. I mean, yeah. As these things are being developed, this really needs to be thought about proactively as the formulas are being developed. I don't think it's something that can be postponed.
Agree. Does anyone think that we can postpone? Okay. All right. Immediate is. And let's go on to the next one. All right. So this is going back to missing health IT infrastructure for health equity and social drivers of health. So we had some discussions right now. At least initially, Hannah, you said longer term, but we're just going to clean the slate in general. So any thoughts on anywhere anybody wants to state where they are on this?
I would also agree with longer term, just simply because we're developing the new US CDI standards that are coming out that include a lot of social drivers of health componentry that should be out by then. We should have some more data. V3 should be at that point, hopefully non-voluntary and required. And V5 should be published by then, I would think, in the next 2 years or so. So we'll have some better data to really tackle this of what's missing, per se, in my humble opinion.
So Aaron, you bring up some really good points. Of course, you know me, I was going to say this is immediate, but you are so incredibly right that there are several actions in play right now, which will really incorporate some of this information. What I would just say, though, I would still vote for immediate only because I still feel like the infrastructure, while there's lots of different activities going on, I'm not quite sure if they're all coming together. So maybe part of building that new infrastructure or assessing it is ensuring exactly as you verbalize, Aaron, that we're all tracking along the same way in terms of what do we currently have and then being able to identify those gaps there.
Interesting. It's a good point. Other thoughts?
Yeah. I still would sort of say longer term. And again, if we jump down one page, right, we start talking about the public health kind of infrastructure. I would say there's some dependencies here, as Aaron sort of points out with USCDI 3 is coming out. And I think there's some infrastructure dependencies, and that, right, when we're talking about longer term, we're talking about a year, right, or a year and a half, in the next 2 years, right? We certainly do need to be focusing on this, but I am not, I do think that there's some infrastructure dependencies here that I would focus on probably first, right? How do we actually get the CBOs to adopt tools? How do we get them funding to adopt those tools before we start driving the actual data, the SDOH data that they're collecting? I didn't necessarily see those both as part of this because I saw the infrastructure piece below. And so that's why I put this longer term. If we are specifying that that driving and improving infrastructure of CBOs, which I did not fully read in here, is part of this, then I may reevaluate. But I did not see that in here. I saw this as more of the adopting standards. And I'm not sure the CBOs are quite ready to do that again.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Hannah. I guess for number two, I took it as looking at the framework, like exploring the development of a framework to support the adoption and implementation. So I took that as less of standards, but more of looking at infrastructure, but completely hear your comments and Aaron's comments.
Anna?
Uh-oh. Anna, we saw you come off of mute, but we don't hear you.
Here, I'm just grabbing something to drink. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
All right, so we're kind of split decision here is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I would have stepped up the room to grab something to drink. And I apologize, I missed part of the discussion. I'm sorry.
Oh, no worries. So we're looking at infrastructure for health equity and social drivers of health data, and trying to decide term is a near term or not. And kind of the debate goes both ways. One is standards are still being developed and rolled out. So there could be an argument to wait until those are rolled out to see what's going on. Or to what Madel said, there's such a need, a grave need for coordination of activities that it could be immediate to help steer those and make sure that everybody's rowing in the same direction per se. So the question is, do you have comments, Anna, from your perspective on timing of this? And you know, it's like the chicken and egg, what comes first?
Yeah, I don't know that I feel strongly one way or the other, to be honest. I guess my concern would be, and I have had very limited work interface with, public health centers or community-based organizations that serve, the people with less resources. So I will throw that out as a caveat. I just, to the extent to which I have been involved in discussions around, they seem to be so resource limited that the idea, I don't know. I mean, are they even going to have updated computers that could be able to like access this kind of information? I could be completely wrong. Maybe that's an outdated, an assumption based off of outdated information. But since most of the funding from those places come from the states, I believe, is it realistic for ONC to develop standards or to suggest that standards are developed for this? And again, I have remarkably little knowledge about this space. So others who do have better knowledge about it, please overrule me or tell me I'm completely wrong. But
so one of the important aspects of USCDI, right, uplifting the EHR vendors and the EHR products is to then be able to exchange a discrete data of SDOH data, which then the CBOs and others leverage those data elements. And the thought is, if you certify a system that has these criterion elements, at some point the far end, right, the CBO or other entity that could be state funded would need to receive that data or vice versa, right? And then up the ante with potential carrots and sticks over the years to force the issue, much like meaningful use, although it makes me cringe every time saying those two words nowadays. But the reality is it's sort of that incentive-based drivers to move forward. The question is, though, is the time right to do that at this very moment, or wait a hot minute and then do it once some more standards are rolled out? That's, I think, to the point of what we're being asked to decide. But correct me if I'm wrong, Madel, or anybody else.
No, Aaron, you're absolutely correct. And Eliel, I almost feel like I saw you about to say something, but if you're unable, that's completely fine. And maybe what we do, if we cannot right now, let's put longer term, since right now it's we're a little bit split on this, but then when the whole work group can take a look at it, and then we can have an additional discussion. Yeah. Because this is going to happen, but the real decision is, do we really make this as a recommendation now, or do we wait to see everything else come out and then move forward with this work?
Right.
Okay.
And Madel has tried to jump in as well as I'm driving, and I'm not sure if you can hear me okay, but I have a few thoughts. I think overall, you know, given the challenges that we face throughout the pandemic with services delivery, and it wasn't just for underserved populations, it was for everybody, right? That I feel like we can't wait for another disaster to have a process in place for SDOE, for social services. That's one thought. The second one was that, you know, there is a really extensive variability of services out there, right? And I agree with Anna, some of these services providers are really not have the capacity, but that's not the case for any of them. And some of those programs are critical for improving health overall. And I'll mention two here. Federal programs, especially SNAP and WIC, which, you know, is for nutrition and highly necessary. And we know that there's direct impact of improving health. But it's still, you know, if you look at WIC, only 15% of the population actually even benefit from that service. And for SNAP, I think 33 million people could still benefit from SNAP. And in the case of, like, for instance, here in Central Texas, our Central Texas Food Bank serves 21 counties. It's a massive operation. So it's not a small shop, meaning they're going to have the technology. They're going to have the computers. They distribute food, you know, throughout a very large group of the population and work directly with Medicaid program to get folks signed up for it. What we don't have is a process to actually monitor this referral process in detail and know exactly where things are falling through the crack. I think you saw in my presentation at the face-to-face meeting. And my point I'm trying to speak to all that to say is, like, when we talk about this new age, it's so much, but if we just focus on maybe federal programs and how we can put the systems in place and these standards to allow the communication to exist fully, the impact would be tremendous. We don't need to solve every SDOH problem, but at least maybe focus on a few key ones. Hope that helps.
Yeah, good feedback.
Yeah, thank you, Elio. And be safe driving.
Yeah.
Oh, so Elio, we heard you say that you're voting for immediate then.
Yes, that would be my position because it needs to be changed a little bit. We can't just say for everything because then we really get ourselves in a challenge, but maybe focus on certain specific federal programs that are high impact, like the ones I mentioned. It could be others.
Okay. So we're still a little bit divided, everyone. So why don't we, there's maybe what we do, we sit on this for a moment and then we'll come on back to it because we still do have some prioritizations that are coming through. And then we can get the feedback also from Anna as well as from Jim because we're about two. And then Anna is also thinking about it and then we'll get Jim. So let's leave it right now for longer term and then we'll circle back to this so we can get through some of the other areas.
Agreed. Okay.
Great. So reducing the digital divide, general, is this immediate or is this longer term?
Needs to happen yesterday.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. This needs to be immediate. And as you see my comments there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is a prerequisite to
everything
else that we're trying to do.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah.
Great.
Excellent. Thank you, Anna. And I think Elio will agree too. All right. Next one, reducing the digital divide. This is increasing access to accessibility and telehealth services, immediate or longer term. Well, I'll jump out there. I think that this is immediate. And the only reason why I think that this is immediate for us to explore is because I think the window for opportunity is closing. So if this is a part of our discussion with, especially with the other entities like CMS and others, we know that there has been some movement of thinking about what to do in this space. So I would say, especially for something coming from the from the HITACS annual report, just mentioning the importance of some of this work would be important. And so I would say it's immediate at this moment.
So Madhu, I think this is where my comment kind of came into play there, right? I think that some of this is dependent on parity, right? And how much CMS and others allow for continued payment parity. If audio telehealth services continue to have, continue to be given payment parity, especially by the public payers, to me, there isn't quite as much urgency here as there is, around sort of other things, right? I think telehealth is sort of broad, right? There's the telehealth visits and sort of ambulatory telehealth visits. Then there's things like remote patient monitoring in telehealth and hospital at home that fall under telehealth. And I think some of those things and reducing the digital divide to allow for some of those sort of more complex functionalities can be longer term if there is in the immediate payment parity so that populations who don't have as much access can continue to receive remote services in the ways that they can. And so I think that's why I put it longer term, also because just everything can't be immediate right now. And so how do we triage and how do we, phase these approaches? And so, but I agree with you, this falls very well under sort of just overall reducing the digital divide. And we have a lot of examples, like current examples of how this can be, of the ways in which the digital divide has created inequities, specifically around telehealth in the past few years. But I do think that there are ways in which some of this can be needs to be addressed more immediately than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Hannah, I think you bring up a lot of good points in it, and it goes back to what we really want to focus on for this topic, because payment parity is a huge piece. Especially when it comes to what we're doing, and let's just say at least with televisits. And I think what this one was really referring to is making sure that the design of the telehealth services that were provided were inclusive of nature, and especially inclusive in terms of language alignment, as well as ability alignment for all of our various different patients that may have diverse abilities, that may be non-English speakers, and ensuring that we're supporting more of those various different approaches and standards for that before things just continue to grow. So you bring up a really good point. And then because we haven't really discussed payment parity and also the use of all the various different forms of telehealth in this topic per se. So that's one of the things we have to look at. And so unless we want to add to this topic, or if that is something, or if we feel something, I mean, at this moment, I feel like we need to either keep to this topic or slightly refine it. But I think that this topic was really focused more on increasing the inclusivity of the telehealth services so that all people can benefit from it.
That's right. That's how I read it, Adele. Yeah. So for me, I would say immediate. This kind of goes hand in hand with the above one, digital divide. I don't think we can wait anymore. I think it's getting worse day by day, the more ambiguity there is in the market, my humble opinion.
Yeah, and I know I already said I agreed, but I do think this is immediate. I think it's going to get easier and easier to chip away at the access to telehealth. And I think that's been one of very few like bright spots that came out of the pandemic is greater access. I think that's really important to increasing access to good care, particularly for people who live in remote areas or have difficulty accessing, in-person care. And it's certainly been a huge benefit for patients who have disabilities or, parents of patients who have disabilities. So I think this needs to be a priority, figuring out how to make this thing that has increased, in my opinion, equitable across those who have less digital resources.
Right. All great pieces. So it sounds like we're going to look at this one for immediate right now, but let's definitely keep in mind every single thing that you said, Hannah, because you were spot on. And that's the other piece of all of these services as well. All right, we have a few more minutes. We're going to keep on jamming through to the next one. All right, Aaron, I'm going to turn it on over to you for page 3.
All right, so gaps in infrastructure and standards to support data sharing. Of course, this is a need for infrastructure to support that data sharing, et cetera, et cetera. It's one of the ones that we have been targeting and looking at for some time since public health became an area for the high tax. This has been on here for quite a hot minute. And we all saw the limited gaps of having to, all of us that had to do that, email various agencies because there was no interoperability. So we resorted to email systems and fax machines because that's what we do. So from a proposed tier, I'm going to go ahead and go on a limb, being that I was one of the ones that had to live through this. Immediate, we need to deal with this. This is an issue. And knock on wood, if there's another global outbreak, we're going to be right in the same basket of worms because nothing has really been addressed. That's my opinion.
Agree.
Okay. Any dissent? No? All right. Next up, interoperability. All right. Support data linking, lack of standardized health data linking has resulted in interoperability, disparity of interoperability across systems and states. Kind of what I was saying earlier, understanding how we can get that data to go. To me, it's the same argument I had before. It's immediate, just because the need is so great. Anybody disagree? Okay.
Yeah, definitely immediate.
Next, interoperability standards, labs and pharmacies. Testing mapping to Loinc and SNOMED. Pharmacies lack integration and they also lack the desire to in some cases, depending on which pharmacy it is, if I'm being completely candid. Explore the requirements for reference laboratories to meet USCDS standards, help pharmacies leverage TEFCA for treatment purposes. That'd be wonderful. And explore requirements for the provided NDC and RX norm codes. I will say the pharmacy task force is meeting actively with a bunch of recommendations to come out. So we'll be hearing that this Thursday as sort of a preview, not for anything to vote on, but we'll be hearing a lot of their good work, which will be positive, right? So it kind of also matches this topic in some way or fashion. Okay, so proposed here, Hannah, you saying longer term. Thoughts, questions from folks?
So I'm leaning towards what Hannah's mentioning too. I would love to see a bit more of what even our work group comes out with and what their recommendations are. And I don't know if we will have time to then come back to this to assess based off of what their recommendations are, how we would like to proceed with the annual report. But I would say longer term right now to understand their assessment and their recommendations first.
I would agree.
I feel like laboratories are different than pharmacies. Like, I think laboratories is immediate. Pharmacies, I mean, when I'm on the pharmacy work group, that's a little more complicated, but I don't know why laboratories aren't going to be required in books.
Yeah. You're right. And it's interesting, though, if you look at CAP inspections and CAP rules for labs, right, and what they require there and that. I'm going to use maze as the word, that maze you have to navigate for CAP inspections, as well as for any of the CLIA certified labs and everything else that folks were spinning up to support the COVID testing, mass testing, right? Like we did in my prior life. It's very interesting maze that you have to navigate to get that going. So I don't know, even if we wanted to go immediate, how we would go about that. Maybe potentially kicking off listing sessions to figure out how to do it, how to navigate that. I don't even know where we would start.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm sure there are an incredible amount of details that I just don't understand. But I mean, laboratories have been sharing structured data for a long time with doctors, direct to the EHR, and also direct to like patient portals. So like they have the capability, the data structure, we know what it means, we know where it goes in the EHR. I don't know why they're not included. pharmacies are more complicated, but I see lab as like an immediate, this needs to happen.
Hannah?
Yeah, I think, sorry guys, I can't see your hands up. Yeah, I tend to agree with Anna that labs is a bit different, and I agree with everybody as well that the pharmacy task force is already doing great work there, so you know, we've got to wait for that. But on labs, I don't know, I feel like Clay McDonald would be a good person to reach out to, get some ideas, given that his work there at Loinc. But I think the biggest issue I've seen on this front is related to hospitals that have the internal labs. It's not as much with lab companies and how to fix that. Maybe not for everything because it's a big mess. But what would be some priority labs that maybe become part of the US CDIs that hospitals have to comply with as well, you know? I remember going through some of that where, you know, 200 or 300 labs for research were important for certain, you know, disease surveillance activities. That might be what's necessary to basically enforce at least a set of labs that need to be harmonized by hospitals.
Yeah, good points, Eliel. Other thoughts?
The lack of interoperability of lab data and lack of sharing, I mean, it has consequences. I mean, told a story. Anyway, I was on a panel last December with Steve Posnack and Devin McGraw, a variety of other people, told the story about going to, you know, my OBGYN, attempting to merge 3 different patient portals just to get access to information about a specific organism that was, in a UTI. And it was it was impossible. We all spent it was a 25-minute attempt to try to get access to the data from different lab values from different portals. And it was just absurd because, again, all of that stuff has been structured and exchanged for quite some time. The issue is, why is it not interoperable?
Mm-hmm. Good points. Okay.
So then when we all come together on this, do we think that with all this wonderful discussion, this is something that's longer term, which just means within a year that we would be able to address some of these interoperability challenges and make those recommendations? Or is this something now that we need to include?
So I would just point out that I do think that lab is complicated as well. And I wonder if there should be a lab work group as well, in addition to how we have a pharmacy work group. I would say from a lab and a pathologist, and I wonder if that has happened in the past as part of high tech. I would say from a lab and a pathologist standpoint, it is not just a matter of mapping to Loinc, right? I hear from my chief of pathology all the time that they are concerned about us just mapping because they don't trust that reference range on that external instrument, or right, they don't trust the methodology on that instrument. There's all sorts of business cases around why they're using this reference lab or that reference lab. And so it doesn't just come down to, hey, they're being lazy and they're not mapping appropriately. They have all sorts of opinions about whether or not this lab or that lab is using the appropriate and the most up-to-date techniques, and whether they trust them and whether they want them in the same record side by side with their techniques, right? And whether semantically they actually do mean the same thing, and the reference ranges should be the same, and they should. And so I think it becomes a debate, not just a, hey, this should be mapped and it can't be mapped. But whether they actually think these are equivalent lab ranges and lab values. And so I wonder if we should have some listening sessions from pathologists, from labs, to understand those challenges, because I think it is more complicated than maybe we understand. I think that there are some of it's economics, and some of it is the science and the clinical state of the field of pathology right now as well, laboratory medicine and pathology. And maybe we should better understand that as well And I wonder if we have done some of that in the past prior to this year. And at least that's the pushback that I get around, hey, let's just go through and do a whole bunch of mappings, right? Which of course, you know, you have a lot of mappings, but you know, why can't just everything be mapped to the same codes?
Thank you for the insights.
That's good feedback. So are we, I guess I'm just trying to make sure we land on something here. Are we all, we're all saying that it needs to be done soon, but I am not hearing like it needs to be done tomorrow. It almost seems to be done in a year. Is that, am I hearing that right? Or I realize it's complicated. So everything is complicated, right? Who knew healthcare was so hard? But the reality is, I just want to make sure we're landing in the right place here, and I'm hearing everybody right. So we're saying longer term, with focuses starting now, just to ask questions, look at the work plan. Maybe there's something ONC could do to start getting things going, organized. Is that what we're saying?
I agree with that.
Anna, did I hear you right?
Acknowledging everything that Hannah said and respecting it, I'm sure there are nuances to different lab tests and lab results that, you know, I don't regularly get. So I'm sure there are real issues, but I feel like maybe for certain lab values, it should be more readily exchanged. This seems to me, again, putting on the perspective of a patient, this seems to me like a really low hanging fruit, and I don't understand why it's not exchangeable at this point.
So
Aaron, understanding it's very complicated.
Right. So Aaron, listening to both Hannah and Anna, I'm wondering if we should just go ahead and put it for immediate, because there's so much work that needs to be done to really rectify this area. So it sounds like this may be an immediate time for some pre-work that then continues to lead into some of the longer term work. And so if we just put it immediate, at least some of those, like, we can recommend some of those initial activities.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. Makes sense to me. We'll gate it appropriately, right? So
exactly.
Yeah, good. Okay. Now, I know we're running really close to public comment here. So should we go to public comment and then come back so we don't start another subject area? What's this group think we should do?
Public comment sounds great.
Yeah, I think public comment is any opinion. Okay. Mike, can we go to public comment, please, sir?
Yeah, we sure can. If you are on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be just on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and once called, press *6. To mute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public would like to make a comment. I'm not seeing any hands raised yet, so I'll turn it back to our co-chairs to finish us out.
Thank you, Mike. Great. And if we go back, we have a couple more minutes. Maybe we can see if we can do one more topic.
Let's do it.
Oh, well, we will try to go fast. All right, so going to supporting interoperability standards for long-term and post-acute care providers. So once again, this is really focused on interoperability across the broader care continuum to include LTPAC providers or LTPAC. So once again, short-term or immediate-term or long-term? Any takers for one of those? Hannah, you say longer-term? I would also say, at least right now, we still have some other work to do. So I would say longer term until we understand this area a bit more.
I agree. Not to take away from LTPACs, they do some great work in the community, absolutely, but they are much further behind. We need to help them out.
100%. And understand the where the gaps are and the needs are.
Precisely.
To really be as effective as possible.
Precisely correct.
Anna, any concern with long term?
No, I mean, it's... No, it's fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everyone. And Elia, we know we'll get your votes too offline. Information blocking, infeasibility exception. And then we have, this is really with looking at all of the information blocking rules and all of the pieces in terms of request to access exchange or use of EHI. And so we do have, Hannah, you put for immediate use. especially if it's not incorporated into the final rule for HTI-1, which we're not aware of yet, or in HTI-2. Any other thoughts from the group?
Immediate, flat out.
Agree with that, Hannah, and I agree with immediate as well.
Yeah, I was just to clarify, right? That right. This is clarification that's needed now, right?
Yep. Oh yeah.
Wonderful.
This is clarification for what, or exactly what
what are the get out of jail cards that you don't have to be meet the criteria, right? And there's a lot of ambiguity in the industry, and I'm hearing. Being quite candid, I'm hearing a lot of vendors trying to skirt the system and provide data for a lot of reasons and giving a bunch of nonsense. So we need to clear this up.
Okay.
Right? Okay. Immediacy availability of data should be the goal for everybody. Bottom line, outside of preventing harm and those few except allowed things, but clearing that up matters.
Yes, agreed.
And that we could definitely feel your passion on that, Aaron. Completely.
Absolutely.
I feel that passion.
I've gotten some aggression on some vendors. Like you were breaking the law. All right.
All right. Well, let's keep that passion going with information blocking for registries as well. And so this is going back, won't go into everything, but in terms of the opportunity assisting in the implementation of existing and upcoming federal policies that could affect access to registry data. And so this is going back, it's very connected to other forms of information blocking. Hannah, you already wrote here that you think it is also immediate. I think that we need to address, I have a feeling we know what Aaron thinks as well. Two thumbs up. Yes. Anna, your thoughts on this piece in terms of if we should approach this now in our annual report?
Honestly, I don't feel that strongly one way or the other about it. I have some concerns about small, advocacy groups maintaining registries and whether or not they have the resources to be able to withstand, some sort of, oversight from ONC. But maybe if the issue is around clarification about what and who would be, fall under the jurisdiction of information blocking, that probably would be helpful. But I just want to raise the issue that all registries are not created equal and resources behind registries are not created equally. So it means, there's a big diversity there.
And the cost for registries is not created equal either. So it's big business.
Super yes. Important comments. Anna, so important. And you're absolutely right. And I hope that if this recommendation moves forward, of course, that would be the feedback, because the recommendation is just to support the development of guidance of how to appropriately implement these registries and who's considered an actor subject to information blocking rules. So that would be some additional feedback that would be provided to ONC. So all really good information there. Appreciate that. All right. Well, then at least we have that done. And looks like we're at the very end of our meeting. So everyone, thank you. We know that we had to do almost rapid fire there, but thank you for the wonderful discussion, thoughtful insights, the prioritizations. And we really appreciate this all of this work. And thank you, Michelle and the Excel team for all of your help as well. Aaron?
Oh, I agree with you. Ditto on that. Have a great one. And we will see you on Thursday.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, all.